Okay, good morning, everyone. We're on our next parsha in the Torah reading. It is Parsha Shmini. However, it is now we're going to have the third of the four special Torah readings, which started a few weeks ago with Parsha Shkolim and continued with Parsha Zohar last Shabbos. And this week we take out a second Sefer Torah, read from the beginning of Parsha Chukas, and we call this Parsha's Parah. It is the Parsha of the Red Heifer, the Parah Aduma, in which it describes how Moshe Rabbeinu created the Parah Aduma. He took a red heifer, burnt it, and those ashes, with a combination of water, special water, and the ashes, they become the formula that people who come in contact with the dead, who achieve a state called Tuma impurity, and they get the waters of the Parah Aduma are sprinkled onto the person, and the person becomes tar, becomes holy. And that is the special Torah reading that we're going to read with the second Torah this week. Now, Parah Aduma is not your conventional animal offering, but rather, you know, we're mixing ashes with water and other ingredients, and all of a sudden, the person becomes pure. And that is a total mystery. How does that happen? Number one. Obviously, Judaism does not believe in all of a sudden, you know, just sprinkle some water on someone, they become pure. Abracadabra, all your sins are washed away. You know, obviously there's much more to it than just simple actions. So what's the system behind this in which we're saying that the sprinkling of the water helps the person? Number one. Number two, why do we read this special Torah portion at this time of the year? Because in order, we're coming up to the holiday of Pesach, now we're thinking about Pesach. In order to bring a Korban Pesach, you could not have any Tumah. You could not be Tumah, specifically Tumah Mace. If you came in contact with a dead person, it gives off a Tumah, which we will explain these terms during the course of the lesson. And you therefore, you need the Parah Aduma to purify the person so that they could bring the Korban Pesach. So the Gemara asks a question, and it's after the, in the after that first source on the below on the right side in the italicized, the Talmud Yerushalmi says, but it seems that the order of the parshas doesn't make sense. We're going to have another special Torah reading the following week called Parshas Achodesh, which we're taught about the idea of sanctifying the months. Now, the truth of the matter is, in the actual order, Chodesh should have come first. Because Chodesh means we learn to sanctify the months, and we start with the month of Nisan. Now, the Mishkan was erected on the first day of Nisan, but the Parah Aduma was only brought after the Mishkan was up. And therefore, Chodesh is read either on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, comes out on a Shabbos, or the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And that came before, chronologically, before we had a concept of Parah Aduma. Parah Aduma is only after the Mishkan was built, which was already at the first of Nisan. So really, if you're looking at the order, we should have had Chodesh, which tells us about Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and then the Parah Aduma, first one, was brought after Rosh Chodesh Nisan. That's what the Talmud asks. And the Talmud answers, he says, Mipnei Tarosan Shel Yisrael, because purity is so fond to God and to the Jew, that the Jew cannot contain themselves to wait until after the reading of Chodesh to be involved with purity. So the first available moment is after Purim. So we read Parshas Parah right away. We can't contain our happiness with the opportunity of being able to achieve a state of purity by having the waters of the Parah Aduma being sprinkled on us. And Rashi comments over there. He says the whole Passover service is a very important one to us. It's the concept of us being servants of God. And this, and the whole Korban is a great feast and a celebration of becoming family with God on Pesach. And therefore, anything that's necessary to make that happen, if anybody be impure, that they have to bring the Korban, the Parah Aduma. So not only is the Passover sacrifice a joyous thing, but things that enable us to reach that state, to bring it, is also a joyous thing. So that's why we read the Parah Aduma first. However, there's still a problem, because that's all good and well when we had a temple and we really lived with the laws of purity and impurity, and we actually brought a Korban Pesach. But today we have no temple. Today we do not bring a korban pesach. We just symbolically eat a piece of matzah. Today we don't refrain from being involved in the Passover Seder, even if we've been to a funeral the day before. So therefore, it seems to be missing a lot of that importance now. And the order doesn't seem to be make that much sense nowadays. But still we stick to the order of Parah and then Chodesh. So why is that so? Now if you recall, when we started this little mini-series a few weeks ago, we mentioned, and again, I brought down for you source 2, the idea of why we say Parshas between the first special Parsha, Shkalim, and Zohar, there could be a Shabbos in between, or not, depending on how the calendar goes. From Zohar to Parah, there could be a Shabbos in between, breaking it up, depending on the calendar. But from Parah to Chodesh, there can be no break. And this Shabbos will be Parshas Parah, and immediately the next Shabbos is Chodesh. And why could there not be a break? And the Jerusalem Talmud said, it's like the four cups of wine on the Seder night. That between the first and second cup of wine, you could have more wine if you want. Between the second and third, you could have more wine if you want. But from the third and the fourth, you can't have any wine. And we said it's the same concept over here. So again, we want to understand why there can't be this break between the third and fourth. And although we explained it a few weeks ago, we want to get a deeper understanding how these three parshas running up to Chodesh make a complete connection that we don't want to make a break. We're going to reevaluate that concept. And finally, the most important part of the class is what do we mean when we say the words Tamei and Tahor? Which very poorly, again, English is a very poor tool to understand Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language. If you look in your typical English translated Kumashim, they'll say Tamei is impure and Tahor is pure. Okay, when I'm selling health foods, I think I can understand what pure and not pure. When I'm selling ivory soap, I can understand what's 99 and 44 100ths pure. But what do we mean when we're dealing in a spiritual sense when we say the words tahor, you are pure, tamei means you're not pure? So only when we understand those terms can we perhaps appreciate what is it, how this process of the parah aduma, bringing the red heifer, brings a sense of purity and how it can change someone by magically throwing the water on from being impure and to becoming pure, and most importantly, what is any relevance at all to our lives as Jews? We don't have animal offerings, we don't have a Parah Aduma, we don't have a Beis Hamikdash. Why are we learning these things? What is the relevance in my life? We're going to hear the Parshas Parah this week. What's so special about it? That's what we have to understand. Now, one other caveat, that the law of the Parah Aduma is called a chok. It's called a law, a decree. Some mitzvahs we have a better handle of understanding. Some we don't have such a good level of understanding. A chok means you do it because God said so, even though you have no understanding at all of it. Why God gave us those mitzvahs, that's all part of what a relationship is all about. If a relationship is based totally on you understanding everything that your spouse wants, then you have no relationship at all. If there's a level of trust in a relationship, then you're prepared to do things based on the track record of what the person has shown for you in the past. You'll understand that they deserve your trust in the future. When they ask you to do something, you don't have to know why. And therefore, even if God could give us the reasons, some things we just don't have the minds to understand them. But some things, even if God could give us the reasons, He said, I don't want you to know all the reasons for everything because I want you to show me that you trust me. That's part of what a relationship's all about. So Parah is included in being called a chok. How is it that some of the people involved in purifying the person become tamei? How does the waters work, etc.? These are things that are very hard to understand. So whatever explanations we are giving, don't think and say, oh, now we really understand it. We only understand a drop in the bucket, which is enough to make us feel good and to appreciate a little bit about the mitzvah. But whatever we're going to say is very, very far away from the truest understandings of what's going on. So to explain what we're going to have, I'm not going to really be referring so much to what's going on inside the notes I gave you, but your back page, there's a whole piece I brought you, the English translation from the Sefer called the Akedas Yitzchak from Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, a Spanish philosopher. You'll have time on Shabbos to read it over, but most of the points are coming out of that Sefer and from the Kuzari, as we'll explain all these ideas over here. So let's start off with the example that they give. Anything in this world, when it falls into a state of disrepair, there are different levels of spoilage. Let me explain. And the understanding of what we call defilement or impurity, and what happens is understood by appreciating this idea. And there's an interesting idea: when things disintegrate, when things are no longer functioning, there is a inverse relationship between how functional the thing is when it's in a working state, and then how disgusting and repulsive it looks when it's in a state of disrepair. Let me explain. We know there are four levels of existence in this world. Starting with the lowest level is called domain, inanimate objects. From that we move up to tzomeach, plants. From that we move to chai, animals. And then we move up to medaber, human beings who speak. So we're moving up in levels. So let's start at the lowest level. An inanimate object, a rock. If you take a rock and it crumbles, right? It doesn't really bother you to look at a rock that crumbled. You don't get all grossed out. You don't get disgusted by seeing a rock that crumbled. The rock has fallen to a state of disrepair. It's no longer a paperweight. It's now just a bunch of crumbs, sand on the ground. We could live with that. Let's move up a level. A plant. A plant, and for that matter, ain't that gross. A tomato. A nice, red, ripe, rosy tomato looks great. Let it sit in the fridge for 3 months, and then open up your fridge and tell me how repulsive that tomato is. Much more than a rock that crumbled. Right? It was a higher level of existence. When it ceases to function on that higher level, it now becomes more repulsive than a rock that ceases to exist as a rock. If we take an animal and the animal dies, it is even more repulsive to deal with the carcass of an animal when it's fallen into a state of disrepair. But of all the states of existence, take a human being, and God forbid, a human being dies and you leave it around, that becomes much worse. Becomes much uglier, as it were, to see a human being in a state of disrepair. So the point that we're trying to bring across is, the more simple and lower level of existing something has, when it ceases to exist in its level, the less objectionable is its rotting process of falling apart. The more sophisticated the level of existence something has, so the absence of that sophistication is something that is more objectionable to other people. Everybody understands that idea? Okay. This is how we use this analogy to understand the idea of purity and impurity. For things that have lower levels of life, the potential for spiritual growth is minimal. And for that matter, almost non-existent in the first three levels of existence of inanimate, plant, and animal. No matter how much you may love animals, you know, how much spiritual life do they really have? Okay. And on the other hand, the greatest level for spiritual life exists in the area of the human being, with their intellect, their heart, their mind, their personality, the image of God, all these things. There's a tremendously high potential that exists within the human being. Now, the word tumah, which we call impurity, which we will no longer call it impurity, just got to get used to the word, tumah. Tumah means is the state of something being tumah, or a state of tumah. That is a concept where there is a void is experienced in the potential. When there is a void in the potential, a person is created with a certain degree of potential, a certain measure, and a person is meant to reach that potential. The human being is a vessel which can contain a certain degree of spiritual growth and aspiration. And as long as the human being aspires to and endeavors to fill that vessel called the human being with all that potential, from the potential state to the real state, the person is considered alive because he's working on that potential, and that is what we would call the highest state of living. Whatever your potential is, whatever the spiritual potential is, you're working, you're learning how to pray better, you're learning to control your anger, you're learning to be more philanthropic. So you are living the potential, it's coming into reality. The person is vibrant and alive. When a person pulls back and no longer strives for that potential, so the rule is the greater potential that person has, the greater the void is experienced when the person pulls back. A person who has potential and doesn't fill it is in a sense emptier than the person who never had that potential to begin with, and therefore the first person has a much greater void of unrealized potential. And it is that void that is in the person's life that creates a state that we call in Hebrew tum'ah. That is what tum'ah is. It is the existence, the manifestation of non-realized potential. That is what tum'ah is. Why it is that way? I will speak like a physicist. Why does, cold air, expand, right? Expand? It gets heavy, right? Things get cold, cold water gets heavy, right? How are we gonna, why? That's the way it is. That's the rule. So there's a spiritual rule that if an unrealized potential equals tumah, equals a state of tumah. Right? With this, we understand a statement of the Talmud. Talmud says, "Kol ha-godol mechavero," anyone who is greater than his neighbor spiritually, "Yitzro godol mimenu," he has a much stronger yitzro hara. Right? And the question is, why should the bigger spiritual person have a bigger inclination to do evil? Well, on the one hand, the simple answer is to keep a balance of free will choice. If you're a bigger tzaddik, you have to have a greater drive to want to sin, to keep an equal free will choice. But the Maral explains beautifully. He says, "Kol ha-godel," anyone who's greater, it means the person who has a greater potential, the greater your potential, the yitzra godelman, or the yitzer, the inclination is bigger, meaning to say his inclination not to reach his potential is also greater. Meaning the person with the greater potential, if he doesn't address the needs and doesn't fulfill the void, he will allow the yitzer to run wilder than the next person because there's so much unrealized potential, and that's going to make much more trouble for such a person. Okay, person doesn't have a lot of potential. Can't be that bad. That's why you find historically the worst Jews in the world were the ones with the greatest potential. Who are the Jews that caused the most harm to the Jews? Well, we could start early. We could start with Jesus Christ. He was a rabbi of the Gemara. Meaning he was a very great potential. When did not come to the point where he no longer wanted to realize his potential. More blood has been shed because of him than any other human on the planet. And then you have other Jews like Marx and others who have great abilities. Shabtai Tzvi, people who left the religion, became apostates and took the side of the church, were the most rabid anti-Semites as well. And therefore, usually you'll find at work, the people who give you more trouble at work are your Jewish bosses and not your non-Jewish bosses. Because there's more unrealized potential existing, and when it's not used properly, it makes all kinds of problems. And that's a spiritual rule that exists. Again, on a simple level, if you take a brilliant child and put him in a classroom where he doesn't get enough stimulation, enough challenge for his potential, he will usually become the worst behavior problem in the class. What does high IQ have to do with poor behavior? Because he has so much potential there that it has to be realized. And if you don't let him realize that potential, it'll have to be realized in the wrong places. When a person is happy, the Yetzirah can't tear the person away, because you're not frustrated. And that's why in Hasidic thought it says the greatest sin is depression. Because why? In a state of depression, a person's down, he doesn't feel like he's reaching his potential, and the Yetzer Hara has lots of fertile territory to make trouble. Okay? So, and this is the concept of tumah. And that's why the laws of tumah will change greatly depending on the object we are dealing with over here. This explains the very interesting and unusual laws. The Talmud says, for example, there's a concept of tumah, that if there's a dead body in a room, it gives off a tumah to everybody in the room. If you go to a funeral, an indoor funeral, you have to wash your hands to take the tumah off, as it were. It's not totally off, but a little bit is off. A Kohen is not allowed to enter a funeral home, even though he's not touching the dead body. All right. Now, it's interesting. That type of tumah only applies to a Jew. Right? Not a non-Jew. So technically, a Kohen could go into a non-Jewish funeral, because the body does not, the non-Jew does not give off a tumah to the building, but only if you touch and come in contact with the non-Jew. He has a lower state of tumah. You have to touch the non-Jew to be tummy. A Jew, you don't have to touch a dead non-Jew. We're talking about dead. A dead Jew, you're in the same room, you become tummy. Right? So what are you going to say? Sounds very anti-Semitic. The answer is no. The two people have two different tasks, two different missions, two different potentials. The potential of the Jew is much greater than the potential of the non-Jew. And therefore, since the Jew has a higher mission, so the lack of life and the passing from this world means that potential is over. There's a greater void. Therefore, there's a higher state of impurity. Okay? That condition that expresses the non-realization of potential, which is here in death, will create a greater sense of tumah. Okay? Everybody understand that? In the Mishnayos, it says, there was one rabbi, or the Medrash, it's source number 3, I don't have time to read it all in there, but there was one rabbi who says, I don't understand these laws of Paraduma, it doesn't make sense, why should this be Tamei Torah? So the rabbi says, is this the only thing you don't understand? How about if you touch, do you understand this, said the rabbi? What else if you touch a dead donkey? A dead donkey, I mean, donkey is about the lowest of the low, right? You do not become Tamei. But if you touch the bones of a Torah scholar, you'll become Tamei. If he's dead, right? If he's dead. So why? It's the same idea. Same idea. There's so much potential is lost. What potential does a donkey have? Right? Dor Chaim HaKadosh gives another example. The two utensils. One was filled with garbage and one was filled with honey. You empty out the contents of both of the utensils. Which one will attract flies? The one that had the honey. The one that had the honey will attract more flies now that it's empty than the one that had the garbage. The same idea. The concept of tumah means the more unrealized potential, the more tumah exists. If there is no potential at all, there's no tumah. So if a rock crumbles, it doesn't give off any tumah. If a flower withers, a tomato rots, doesn't give off any tumah. If a donkey dies, doesn't give off any tumah. Human being dies, that's another story. Because there's so much more potential over there. Okay? That's point number one. Alright? Any questions up to this point? Because now we're going to take it to the next step. The next step is the more challenging one. Yeah?
You're going to talk about
Tahor
as well.
Talk about what?
Talk about purity.
Purity?
Is the opposite of
purity? Purity is when you're not in that state.
But aren't we always like, we're mixing spiritual and physical.
Then. No, we're not. No. Well, you know, why don't you just, let me get to step two. And I think when I get to step two, I think what issue you're bringing up will get answered. So now, right now it seems that everything we're talking about, tumah and tahara, this tumah exists at the point of death. And the truth is the laws of tumah and the necessity for the pora aduma, the red heifer, to take away the tumah, indeed apply only when a person dies. And tumas mace, you know, you become tummy by touching a dead person. It really has to be a dead person, which gives off the strongest tumah. And when you touch it, you become tummy. As the void appears, is obvious when the person's dead. There's no question about it. However, truthfully, this is not entirely correct. Because the condition of tumah does not begin only at the time of death. It begins before. Why? Because nothing can come which in the death of the person which did not exist in the lifetime of the person. Which is an axiom of tumah and tahara. That any tumah that you say exists upon death cannot have existed unless it existed in the time of life. And we'll have to explain that, why that is so, but this is a rule. And on a simple level, we can explain that when Hashem created a human being with a physical body and a spiritual soul, the demands of both are quite often different from each other. Ultimately, if you put the two together and the two are working together, God's intention is that there could be a harmonious unity between the body and the soul, and the body does not exist merely to serve itself and its own feelings and sensations isolated from what the spiritual aspect of the person is. But rather, the body is meant to act as a tool and a vessel to assist the soul in its spiritual growth. And by virtue of its assisting the human being in its spiritual growth, it too is affected by the neshama, by the soul. And this is what Lutzado in the Derech Hashem talks a lot about. Meaning to say, as long as a person is involved in doing positive activities, we're doing mitzvahs and chesed and learning Torah, don't think that the soul is mamish flying high and growing by leaps and bounds, and the body is twiddling its thumbs, totally bored. In the deepest sense, that's not what's happening at all. Rather, as the soul is growing spiritually, the body receives a certain degree of spiritual health from the soul of the person, and the body is elevated by the fact that the soul is engaged and active and that the body is connected to that. That is the reality that happens. Every time you do a mitzvah for the right reason, whatever, you do a good deed for the right reason, that is the soul is engaged and is sending powerful energies into the body, and the body is experiencing an elevated state as well. That's the way God made the human being. Now, why is that so? Who says it's true? What's the basis for this formula to say it's true? It's very simple. Because everything in this world, anything that exists, cannot exist unless there's a will of God for it to exist. There has to be. Nothing can exist without God's will. You understand that. There was nothing in the world before there was a world. The world only came into being because God willed the world to exist. And not only does He will it to exist once, He continuously wills it to exist. So even the most physical existence in the world, their life feed comes from the will of God, as we now scientifically even know, by the fact that protons, neutrons, and electrons are all running around inside the physical part. Who's making that happen? You can't just say that's nature. There is a God who is willing that to happen on a physical level, on a metaphysical level, and it's the will of God that's keeping everything to exist. So the most physical thing is tied to a spiritual source. That's the realities of life. And that the license of function for the physical body comes because there's a spiritual will for it to exist. So the physical is certainly tied to the spiritual source that feeds it, which is God's will for it to exist. So therefore, even though we have many physical body parts, which seem to be totally void from spirituality, that's not true. If they were totally void from spirituality, what would happen? They'd cease to exist. There's a spiritual energy that's making it exist. So the fact that the soul's there means that it's feeding the body, not only spiritual health, but the very physical existence is fortified by the condition of the soul. So if now, if the soul grows, how does the soul grow? By the mitzvahs that you do, then it strengthens the body. If the soul be gone, the body would die. If you have a stronger soul, you have a stronger body. So the more you do mitzvahs, the more you strengthen the soul, the more you strengthen the body. How far does this formula go in theory and sometimes even in practice? To an extent that there would be perfect unity between the body and the soul, what would never happen? A person would never die. And Lutzado talks about that. Why? Because the spiritual essence of the human being, the soul, never dies. So it never dies, and there's a total harmony between the body and the soul, then the body piggybacks on the soul and never dies. Death is an expression of a physical limitation. But the soul is a spiritual entity that has no limitation. So if both the body and the soul are united together, the body would take on the properties of soul, and that body would never die. And that's why the first man was never meant to die. Only, yeah?
So by extension then, the more religious you are, the older you should get.
Okay, so now you want to make an application. The more religious you are, the older you should get. In theory, that's true. And case in point, Who was the person who always echoed these words, Mi ha'ish hechafetz chayim liros tov? Who's the one who wants to chafetz chayim, live life and have long life? Was the Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan. How long did he live? 93 years old. Right? But you're right, all things being equal, but there's other factors. You know, what if you're a transmigrated soul where you've only, King David, for example, was not supposed to ever be alive. He was supposed to die at childbirth. First man said, you know what, he's too good of a soul. I'll give him 70 years of my life. So, that was a big sign. Why didn't he live longer? Because that's all he was meant to live. So there are certain things where God just puts into the system, this is what's meant. Lutzado was only meant to live 40 years as a Gilgal of Rabbi Akiva, who for the first 40 years of his life was an Amoritz. So his original ticket was only for 40 years, no matter how big of a tzaddik he was. But the theory is there. The theory is, in theory you should live longer, and it is true, generally speaking, but then there's exceptions. God says, well, this one, I never planned on him being more than 40 years, no matter what. That's just the way it is. The Arizal only lived till he was 40. All these people, they died very young, for whatever reason. Hashem said the generation wasn't worthy. We can't have such a tzaddik. It won't work for other, other factors impinging that may not let the tzaddik live longer. Maybe he has to give a kapara for the generation, an atonement for the generation. But in theory, that is exactly true. And therefore, what happened after first man sinned? Then death came into the world, and Lutzado explains, not that it was tit for tat, and God said, you didn't listen to me, and I'm going to punish you, but it's just a reality. When a person sins, and when it's the first sin in history, what does that mean? You've identified your body needs to the exclusion of the soul's needs. If Hashem says, do not do this, you say, I will do this. That means you're listening to what the body is saying and not to what the soul is saying, and you therefore are creating a schism between the body and the soul. And once you create a schism between the body and the soul, you're not allowing the soul to healthfully energize the body. And that's what happens. Then the human being, then the body becomes a regular body with arteries that clog and that eventually die. Instead of the body getting properties of soul, the body remains the properties of body. A body is finite and will never live forever, only if it's totally connected to the soul. So God said the natural consequence, not punishment, natural consequence of a sin of first man is you brought mortality into the world, and human beings forever have suffered from that. So let's now take it one more step here. So where's the source of tumah come from? Let's get it straight now. So he said the first and obvious one is a dead person. True, because now there's no more, the potential is finished. But then again, where did death come from in general? The cause of death from first man was the fact that the physical body, by our choice of separating them from the soul, could not receive and absorb the energy of the soul because of the schism that the person created. Right? That's where death came from, because it's a disconnect. So that, and that's what we said. So now if you have a condition where a vessel can be filled and is not filled, what's that void called? Tumah. So a person's made of a body and a soul, and the soul has the ability to feed into the body's spiritual life. So if it feeds into the body's spiritual life, then the body theoretically could never die. Right? And therefore, there'd be never a concept of impurity of tumah, because the body is full with the soul's energy. That's in a healthy situation. But where does death come from? Because the body cannot contain the energies of the soul wants to put in, because the body's built a brick wall between it and the soul, and it can't absorb. So what do we have? We have a body that was created to absorb spiritual energy that's not absorbing spiritual energy. So what is the body there for? It's a utensil that refuses to absorb that which was intended to absorb, and now the void is created within the body. And that's the tumah. The tumah exists in the body even before it dies, because the body is meant to absorb the energy of the neshama. When the neshama is doing mitzvahs, the body's supposed to be engaged together with the soul and to be the recipient of all the spiritual energy into the soul. The human being who doesn't allow that to happen, and all human beings to one extent or another, by just definition of being children of Adam, there is a certain blockage. No matter how big of a tzaddik you are, there's going to be something not fully activated because of the original sin. And there is going to be certain potential that doesn't exist, and that's how all humanity is doomed to die. Okay? But the real tumah exists to various degrees while you're alive. And what does it all depend on? So now let's think about it. Every look at 50 different human beings, one human being is more tumah than the next. Why? Because one human being has a mindset that refuses to acknowledge more or less the connection of the soul to the body and refuses to do the things that will fill the body with holy spiritual energies. And therefore, this is what the Talmud means when it says the wicked people, even when they are alive, are considered dead. It's a Talmudic statement. So what does that really mean? Although he's physically functioning, there's no feed between the soul and the body. The body is functioning, but merely as an animal. And what do we say about an animal? There's nothing there. But the problem is, but you're a human. And human is meant to absorb a lot of Kedusha. And you have and a lot of potential. And all that potential is being not happening. So now there's Tumah right in the person while he's alive. And it's only finalized irrevocably at his death. Because now he can't fix it. You understand? So clearly, the condition of impurity does not begin to surface at the moment of death. As that's what I said 10 minutes ago. Nothing can happen at death that didn't exist when you were alive.
So, mentally, there's nothing you can do physically while you're alive to purify yourself totally?
Well, so just hang on. We'll see in a minute. Let's look at another piece of Talmud. The Talmud tells us when Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi died, when Judah the prince died, they say an expression, Bakla Kahuna. The Kohenship was nullified temporarily. What does that mean? Normally a Kohen is not allowed to touch a dead body. At Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's funeral, they said all the Kohanim can touch his body. They said that Rabbi Nasi did not give off a tumah. Why did he not give off a tumah? Because he had a perfect harmony between body and soul. Perfect. That body fed, the soul fed the body everything. When right before Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi died, he raised his 10 hands upward. He says, God, and he was very wealthy. He was very wealthy. He was the prince. The table was filled with food. He said, I swear to you, God, I promise you that my little pinky did not partake and have physical pleasures of this world. What does it mean? He didn't have any pleasure. He didn't eat breakfast. The answer is, I never had a physical pleasure because the body wanted the physical pleasure. I did everything by the instructions of the Torah, and you said I have to eat to stay alive. I did that to stay alive, totally for the sake of heaven. I didn't do anything for my body. There wasn't 1 ounce of schism between body and soul. Now, that's the idea of L'shem Shemayim, do things for the sake of heaven. You know, on Purim, for example, we all had a feast on Sunday. Now, you're supposed to have a feast because it's a mitzvah. So I want to know, when you were having that rib steak, could you say that you're doing that 100% for the sake of God? It'd be pretty hard. Maybe 10%, 20%. But 100% for the sake of God, it's hard. It's hard to say that. You know, but that's what the mitzvah is. So we're having at our meal, at our home, we had our meal, I'm having a steak. Usually don't have steak, but God says you have to have a good meal. So I said, well, I don't know if I could say I'm 100% for the sake of God. But then you also have to get drunk on Purim. And I do not like wine. So then I pour this glass of wine, and I take a sip. I can't stand it. I said, this, Hashem, I can promise you, is 100% L'shem Shemayim. I'm mamish, I cannot stand wine. I don't like it. I don't like it. But it says you gotta drink wine and get drunk on Purim. So I'm doing it for the sake of heaven. So imagine, I imagine myself, and I'm drinking that red wine. I just can't stand it. I understand it. A lot of people like it. It's fine. But my body just can't stand it. So I had to drink a whole bottle of it so I could, you know, fulfill the mitzvah. Right? So I said, this I know for sure. I wish every other thing I do would be for the same sake of God for that. Right? But Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was totally like that. Right? So if he was totally like that, the body and soul were always together. He was completely tahor. There was no unfulfilled potential. So when he dies, so why does he have to die? He has to die because there's a decree God said we all have to die. You can't get around that decree. God can't have certain people dying and not dying. The world wouldn't work right. It just wouldn't work. We'd start deifying people. It's just, he can't. But there was no tumah. That's why many opinions say that when you go to Hebron and you go to the patriarchal tomb, a Kohen can go and daven in the Marasa Machpelah, because there's no way Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov gave off tumah. By Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's kever, many people say a Kohen can go there too, because there's no question about it that that man never had any tumah in his life. Right? So although we don't know where the tumah comes from, you know, technically, but we can divine the condition in which it exists. Right? And therefore, somebody like Elijah the prophet never died. He was on such a level, he was just carried away in a chariot of fire, and that was it. But you'll notice, and this explains a lot of interesting phenomena. Why do you have sometimes when righteous people die and they're buried for many years, and unfortunately we have to exhume the body, and you find that the body is 100% intact and as fresh as the day it was laid into the ground? The answer is because there was never any tumah in that person. That body, it remains an eternal body. It will never break down and fall apart. Or the person did something that was unusual that would show that he doesn't follow his body's dictates. Okay, so that explains, so I think that answered your question that you had before. So the issue of tumah and tahara is not a condition to wait to die for it. It's a condition in our lifetime. Now, obviously, we cannot legislate this. This would cause a lot of hard feelings. You can imagine you have a secular Jew and a religious Jew says, "You're tameh, I won't shake your hand." Now, there are a lot of observant Jews who will not shake the hands of non-observant Jews because they really feel that they are tameh. Okay, and let other impure people reach out to them. I'm not going to suggest if it's right or wrong. I remember when I was once visiting in Eretz Yisrael, I was on a bus, I took a bus, and this old Yerushalmi, appeared to be religious, very religious guy, he saw I was a yeshiva bar, he says, "Do me a favor, sit next to me on the bus, because you never know who's going to sit next to you on the bus. I want somebody like you." So I was very honored. But, you know, there is this idea, you know, you go visit a tzaddik, some of these tzaddikim, you can't go in, you're going to go visit, you first go to the mikveh. You want to go in? There'd be a mikveh in the room next door. You go to the mikveh, then you go to Tzai. He's not going to look at you.
Anybody can do tshuva, so...
You could do tshuva, but we'd have to know that you did tshuva. And you have to mean you did tshuva. It's easier said than done. Easier said than done. So, of course, we can't legislate this while people are alive. It would cause a lot of disunity amongst the Jewish people. But we can all agree that when we die, we're all tummy. But in truth, it exists even before. And now you'll see how we apply this even in our lifetimes. And this is where it gets interesting in a moment. We're just ready, got almost all the background to now apply all this in a very meaningful way, as you'll see shortly. Yes?
Will you explain how
a mikvah or the paraduma can... Well, a little bit. With the paraduma, a little bit. A little bit. I don't got time. It's a good question. I need another class for that. I gotta get paraduma. Today's issue is paraduma, right? Mikvah, we'll have to talk about at another time. It's worthy for its own class. But now comes out an interesting paradox, okay? The greater potential a person has, he also has a greater potential to succumbing to negative influences. The greater your potential is, it's terrific if you reach it, but if you don't reach it, you're going to suffer in much greater ways because there's a greater void. Now, there's a medrash that says something fascinating. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, "Lo hamei sametame." It's not the dead who really give off the tumah. As much as we think the source of tumah is in contact with the dead, it's not really that. Now you understand what he means. He says the condition of tumah is an expression of an unrealized potential within the person, and it really doesn't happen only after death. Really? That condition of tumah doesn't begin with death, it begins in the lifetime. That means each and every one of us has to be concerned, perhaps I am tumah in a way that we can't legally define, but certainly spiritually there's a tumah that can exist within me, which we're going to come back to that in a moment. And the second half of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's statement is, v'lo ha-mayim etarim, and it's not the water that purifies. He's saying the water of the paraduma, it's not touching the dead man that makes you tummy, and it's not the water that makes you holy. She looks and says, what are you talking about? The Torah says the water does make you tahar. So what did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai mean? So we'll come back to that right at the end of the class. But now we want to move on to an interesting thing that's at the bottom of your page here. I made a little chart over here. And now you're going to see we're going to make it all fit in now. Right at the bottom. I have a little, not a chart, but whatever, you have a bunch of lines and arrows. We're going to now combine three aspects. So hold on to your horses now. We're going to combine aspects of tumah, aspects of averos, and aspects of character, and line them all up and show you how practical this all is. We know there are three cardinal sins that no matter what, a Jew is not allowed to do these sins. And that is immorality, it is murder, and is idol worship. Those are the three cardinal sins. I got it written right there. You don't have to take notes. It's right there. Three cardinal sins. Murder, immorality, idolatry. Okay. Now, are those three things just activities? Or are they based on character flaws? So, Mishnah says, and I wrote it down right afterwards, Hakina v'hataiva v'hakavod, jealousy, lust, and honor, motzinas adam min olam, they drive a person from the world. And the commentaries say, is there's an integral connection between those three. Now, more often than not 100% of the time, but more often than not, jealousy will bring what? Between murder, immorality, and idolatry. More often than not. Jealousy will bring murder. The first murder of the world happened because of jealousy. Cain killed Abel. It was jealousy. So murder doesn't happen because the guy just shot a gun and killed somebody. More often than not, it comes from jealousy. There's a character flaw of jealousy that causes this terrible behavior. Lust, more often than not, brings to immorality. That's pretty straightforward, right? And finally, honor, this pursuit of honor, can more often than not be connected to idolatry, because idolatry is a misguided pursuit of showing honor. That is idolatry, because it's a you're honoring something that doesn't deserve to be honored. And generally speaking, it's because you think you're smarter than God. Right? And it means you think you're somebody important. Covet. I have covet. A lot of honor. So, I honor myself. Why would I want to honor God? It gives me less honor. I create an idol that I really control, and I really have the honor. It's misplaced honor. So that's those. So we have what? The three personality flaws, right, are responsible for the three main physical averos that we do, or any other averos that can come from it. I certainly believe, there's no question about this, that most of us are not murderers. But because we're jealous, we do things that are just as bad, such as speaking Lashon Hara. The Gemara says, that's like murder. It's like you kill three people. And everybody has some issues with Lashon Hara. So I guess we all have so little problems with jealousy. Usually don't say Lashon Hara about people you're not jealous of. Right? But now let's take it one more step. And this is where we bridge everything. These personality flaws are also responsible for different levels of tumah that existed in the times of the Torah. Right? As we'll see, there were different tumahs with different levels. The strongest level of tumah required a Jew to live outside of the Jewish camp. You had such a strong tumah, you couldn't even be with other Jews. And what was that person called? A mitzora. A mitzora. A poorly translated to English, a leper. Tzaras. What did you get tzaras for? Speaking Lashon Hara. Well, where does Lashon Hara come from? Jealousy. So the character flaw of jealousy leads you to the crime of speaking Lashon Hara, which now the Torah says you get tzaras for that, and tzaras means you are kicked out of the entire Jewish community. That's how strong the tumah is. Let's look at a second. It's all on the chart right over here. Second, taiva, lust, when it's not directed properly, will bring a person to a certain conditions of, we'll just simply put, certain types of venereal diseases, which I don't want to give the detail of, Zav and Zava, where certain flows and emissions come out of the body. But we understand that on a simple level, people who have, what do they call it, sexually transmitted diseases, it's all in the same parsha. I'm not getting into the whole details here, but there's certain emissions that come from your body that are sexually orientated. That comes from lust. And that person is sent out of two of the Jewish camps, but not entirely out of all the Jewish camps. He could be, you're out of the Machane Shechina, the Machane Leviyah, but he could be in the Jewish camp. So you're not, you have a tumah of a little lesser degree. And then finally, kavod, honor, misplaced honor. What does that cause? We already said that causes death to man. Why? Because when first man ate from the tree of knowledge, he wanted to be like God. He wanted to be like God. That was like idol worship to that extent. So death came with the impurity, brings the impurity of tumas meis. Of death brings tumah. So therefore, death, which is a result of misguided kavod, and when you come in contact with a dead person, you only have to leave one of the Jewish camps. The Machane Shechina, where the temple stood, but you could even be in the camps of the Levites. So let's review. So jealousy does what? You speak Lashon Hara, kicks you out of all three Jewish camps. So what does that mean? That means jealousy should have no part of a Jewish personality. Not a drop of jealousy is acceptable. Lust, on the other hand, you get kicked out of two out of the three camps. That says, you know, there still can be a proper expression of lust in the terms of a holy marriage between a man and a woman. So we don't want to totally get rid of the lust. And honor, you're only taken out of one camp because certain self-esteem issues are very important for spiritual growth. And therefore, there's a good place for honor, but not misdirected. I'm only kicked out of one camp. So what are we beginning to see? The mistake is we think that sins are one thing. Personality development is a second, altogether unrelated thing. And this third mysterious idea of tum and tahara is a third thing that's totally not related. And that's not so. We now see that they're all interconnected. There are personality flaws which bring us to do certain activities as a result, as the end result of those flaws. And that's also responsible for the state of tumah. Why? Because how did we define tumah as what? Unrealized potential. What is the greatest thing that hinders and impedes our potential? It's our character flaws. Right? You're capable of this and this and that, but because of your arrogance, because of your lust, because of this, it destroys you. Right? And therefore you don't develop that potential. You get jealous of people, you're talking Lashon Hara, that's not developing your potential. And there's many other character flaws, but these are the three biggest ones. Character flaws is the barrier between your potential being realized or not. Will you not agree to that? Right? And the biggest block, the biggest wall is jealousy. That's the biggest one. Next block is lust. The next block is honor. And there's all other, there's more. I just picked the three big ones. So tumah and tahara isn't just a mystical concept that, you know, either we don't get. It's very, very real. It's extremely practical. Okay? It's either realization of a spiritual potential or a non-realization of a spiritual potential. There's a total demand. Tumah and tahara is a total demand on character development. If you develop your character, you will prevent those things which prevent you from reaching your potential. And then you will be a tahar person. Do you understand? So that's why when you're alive, different people have a different level of tumah or tahara. A person with tahara, obviously, if we say a person is tahor, what do we mean? He's developed all his personality in the right way. And that's the only block. What keeps you back from doing a mitzvah? It's not your philosophical opinions. That's a smokescreen. It's your personality flaws. Plain and simple. If you ask a person, why don't you keep Shabbos? He says, well, you know, I believe everyone has their own way to express how they rest on the Shabbos. Nonsense. It's plain and simple. You think you're God. You have an ego this big. And you don't trust. You're not trusting. That's all. That's the character flaw. That's the only thing that keeps you from keeping Shabbos. There's nothing else keeping you back from keeping Shabbos. Everything else is an excuse that you can let yourself think you're a tzaddik and sleep well at night. But you have tremendous covet issues. You think you're smarter than the Creator. Now that's a big flaw. Your ego is incredibly big. So now that's a tumah. That's a tumah. All these, got a temper. Say all these things. What's keeping you back from being the observant Jew? It's a character flaw. The character flaw. That's the tumah. Because you have a soul that wants to put in so much good, healthy energy. And you're blocking. You're not letting it go in. And the greater the character flaw, the more you block going in. So we got people walking around all the time with tum all over the place. Now, don't you think we need to purify that? Do you have to go in a mikvah to do that? Now, on a halachic level, you do. We can't forget about the halacha. If a woman has to go to the mikvah after a certain period of time, I don't want to get into woman and mikvah, that's another class. You've got to go, well, I just think of improving character flow, I don't have to go to the mikvah. No. But when it says it's the waters of the paraduma, we'll come to paraduma in a second, it's not the waters alone that are going to purify. Just going to the mikvah, not thinking about anything, isn't going to help either. I mean, halachically, technically, we could say it works, but you're missing the point. So now that we have this idea, now we're going to go back to the four parshas, and see what really is happening on a deeper level. Because what do we have to do by Pesach? By Pesach, we want to get freedom, right? What do you want that freedom for? What do I need to have freedom for? You need to have freedom to realize your potential. Yeah?
Wouldn't it make sense then that you would purify yourself through learning, studying, through mitzvah observance, spiritually? You fill your potential through spirituality,
but there's one critical step before that. It's the character. Why are there people who don't learn Torah? Why is this fellow not learning Torah? Why is this fellow, yes, learning Torah? There's a character flaw behind it. Why is this guy, yes, going to shul to daven, this guy not going to shul? Why is this guy giving tzedakah and this guy not giving tzedakah? There's a character flaw, and that's the key. It all depends on the character flaw. So let's take a look at the three parshas, two that we've read and the third we're going to read. And now we're going to take one more. So this is all from the Shem Mishmuel. And now you understand, we've interconnected character flaws, bad actions, tuma. So now let's take it one more step. Now we want to correct the character flaws, right? So what's going to inspire us to correct the character flaws? Let's look at the three parshios that we're reading and see how they relate. So let's start with Shekalim. What was the mitzvah of Parsha Shekalim? To give a half silver coin. Who gave the half silver coin? Everybody. What about the rich guy? The same. What about the poor guy? The same. What is that combating? Jealousy. There can't be any jealousy if everybody's being treated the same. And more than that, if you're jealous of what others have, it's very difficult to part with what you have. And if you realize, you know, all the symbolism, the half coin, you're like a half person, and everybody's like a half person, who's there to be jealous over? Shkalim was meant, the Shabbos is Shkalim, you have to deal with your jealousy. Deal with jealousy. And that's one of the biggest roadblocks. That's the biggest block. Now we can take care of that. Let's move on to the next one. Zohar, last week. Now, Amalek. Amalek is most hated because one of the things they, as we spoke about, they're the people without values, right? Well, if you don't have any values, what's one of the first values to go?
Morality.
Right? Talmud tells us symbolically that Amalek has such a disdain. Amalek had such a disdain for the Jews that there was one time when they killed a bunch of Jews who were outside of the camp. They made a pile of foreskins And they said, "Ooh, you love circumcision so much. Here." And they threw the foreskins in the air, as if to mock the entire concept of morality. Amalek hates the sense of morality within a Jew. We read Zohar to become firmly entrenched in the fight against that personality flaw of taiva, of lust. Remember, we said Amalek is the one, what's their code word? They say big deal, right? Big deal. There's no values. Normally, people who are entrenched in immorality, they're totally insensitive to spiritual values, and they say, big deal, there's no spiritual value. Want to know more about it? I spoke about it in this morning's class in the Navi. We spoke a lot about that idea. Okay? So now Zohar goes against immorality. Para, the para aduma. What's the main ingredient of the para aduma that you sprinkle? What's the main ingredient? Ashes. And what else do we throw in? I didn't tell you. We throw in hyssop grass. That's a low-growing grass. It never grows very tall. And you mix it with water and you throw it onto the person. What is ashes and hyssop grass symbolic of? Humility. It's to combat your arrogance, right? The Talmud says, in what merit did we get the mitzvah of the Parah Adum and the merit of Avram, who said, when Hashem says, you're going to get this, you're going to get that, he says, Anochi Ofer Ve'efer, I'm just but dirt and ash. The more humble the person is, the less arrogant you are going to become. So when they throw the waters of the paraduma on the person, he's supposed to be inspired to be humble. You could throw water all day long. If the guy isn't humble, then he's going to suffer in that schism of him able not being able to give covet in the right place. And that will hold him back spiritually. So it's not the waters per se, it's the message of the waters. So now we can understand that, remember we said last time in Zohar, we have to take on the war to fight Amalek. We have to be warriors to fight Amalek. So once we're fighting the war of Amalek, we think we're really amazing people. So then God says, and you have to have a dose of humility as well. Don't have a swelled head. Don't think now that you're fighting the battles of Amalek, you have this, righteous indignation mode, where you're not tolerant of anybody, and you become you're not a humble person. Even if you fight battles for God, and you have to destroy the enemy, you still have to remain a humble person. But then after you become a humble person, you say, if I'm so humble, I don't know if I can really make all these big changes in my life. And that's what Parshas Chodesh is all about. Chodesh means it's a new month, the idea of the power of time, the power of change. Time is a function of change. The fact that the times change means a person can change. And therefore, we have to right away, as soon as we've got these three levels that we have to gain that freedom, we have to take advantage immediately. You don't waste any time. Once I've removed myself from the three major personality flaws, now I'm ready for freedom. But freedom alone is, now it's worth something, because now I can fulfill the potentials that I have. And there can be no break, because if I don't engage in something positive, then those old character flaws are going to pop back in very quickly. If I've gotten rid of them, you just can't sit back without any flaws. You got to engage positively. So now make the changes. Chodesh means make the changes now to make me the person that you want to become. So that's the progression that we have over here. Each week we're working on another. So this Shabbos, we have to mamash be thinking about how we can be more humble people. And how to stop worrying about COVID issues. That this person didn't invite me to this simcha, and why did this person talk to that one and didn't speak to me at the Kiddush, and this and that. All these things, they bring about this diminution of who the person can become. So now the only thing that's left, now it becomes very clear. So, but we don't have the paraduma. We don't have the waters. So we're not going to get it. But the answer is, it's not the waters that purify. I mean, halachically, yes. But existentially, no. It's not the death that makes you tame. It's not the waters that make you tar. It's the character flaws that make you tame. So what's going to make you tar? Removing the character flaws. So when you go to the mikveh, it's very close. Mikveh is the same idea. You're trying to remove the character flaws. Just like when you, very simple. What do you do when you go into water? To wash yourself, to remove the dirt. So the dirtiest thing, the dirtiest Jew, is a Jew with character flaws. That's a dirty Jew. A clean Jew is when you go to the mikveh and you've removed the character flaws. That's why before Shabbos, men are supposed to go to the mikveh. Symbolically, what are you saying? I may have picked up a lot of character flaws from Sunday, but now I'm going to wash them all away. Not just, you know, whoop-de-doo. I got to rethink, what did I do? Where was my arrogance? I got to stop the arrogance. I got to stop this. I got to say, because for me to really enjoy what Shabbos is all about, can you imagine how a person who has a lot of jealousy, a lot of lust, and a lot of honor will come into Shabbos? You know how that Shabbos looks for that person? Person fresses every meal, goes to a kiddish club during davening, gets insulted when he doesn't get the most important aliyah, and he is jealous of the rabbi, and therefore only can say destructive words about his speech. Now you've taken Shabbos, you've been a chilul Shabbos, 100% chilul Shabbos, even though technically you didn't do one of the 39 activities. Shabbos to a person who doesn't do tshuva is destructive to the person. Better not to have Shabbos, almost. Do you understand? A guy with time on his hands, better should work. He's work, has no time to be jealous. A guy comes to shul with jealousy, with lust, with desires for honor. What happens? He lets it all hang out in shul. And what does that create? The greatest desecration. The rabbi can say beautiful words. The guy's jealous of the rabbi. He pulls everything down what the rabbi says. He has to go out during the haftarah to hear the kiddush because he's a fresser. And he didn't get shlishi. He's going to call the board right after Shabbos to address his complaints, to fire the gabbai. And that's your nice Jewish Shabbos. Better to work. Better to work. Go to the mikveh. Do tshuva. Get rid of your issues. Leave your character flaws at the door. Come to Shabbos pure. When I come to Pesach. What do you need? What do you need freedom? What did Jews have to be free? Free to exhibit all their negative characteristics? That's what God made you free for. That's why Purim comes before Chodesh. Because the Jew instinctively knows what's more important is purity. If I don't work on my character flaws, then nothing God gives me is any worth a dime. Is this not practical? Do you have to be religious to accept this? Do you have to be religious? How many problems are in marriages because of lust, honor, and jealousy? You're not a religious Jew, right? You're jealous of your wife, so what do? You lust after the secretary. Because she gives you a lot of honor. Oh, the secretary understands you. The wife doesn't understand. The secretary understands you. The barracuda understands you. You don't have problems like this? You don't have to be an observant. Forget about being an observant Jew. You don't have to deal with these three things. You enjoy your life? You don't enjoy your life. This is tumah. You're living with tumah. Got to get rid of that tumah. Right? So one last point. So we don't have the paraduma, but the concept behind it that we have it. So now the question is, what makes the mitzvah of reading paraduma a mitzvah? Why is it a mitzvah? What makes it a mitzvah? The Torah said so. What does that mean? And let me reframe that. What makes sprinkling the waters of the paraduma? When we had a temple, sprinkle the waters, and now magic, the tumah goes away, right? What gives it the magical power? The fact that there's a number of verses in the Torah that describe the process. The Torah mitzvah is what gives the power to the mitzvah. Right? It's the will of God expressed in the words of the Torah that say, now, create the ashes of the heifer, sprinkle the water on the person, and that will create the purity. And all the ideas that are behind that. And where did that all come from? What smart person thought of that? Nobody. God. It was the will of God that invested this mitzvah with this holiness. So now if you can't do the mitzvah, so then the mitzvah is only really the secondary manifestation of the primary root, which is the Torah itself. Let's say, for example, a person wants to have soup. And there's a huge, huge pot. Like they had on Purim. Like a huge pot. Right? So, and imagine you want to have some soup. So what do? You put some ladles around the pot. So you take the ladle, you put it in the soup pot, and you put it on your bowl, and you're able to have the soup. Right? So now, what happens if there ain't no ladle? And there ain't no bowl. And there's a huge soup pot. What are you going to do? And you're hungry. What are you going to do? Manners, putting Emily Post aside. You're famished. You're hungry. There's no ladle. There's no bowl. A giant soup pot with lots of soup in it. What do? You stick your face in the soup and you drink it. I said manners aside. Because if the soup isn't coming from the bowl and it ain't coming from the ladle, it's coming from the soup pot. Judaism, Torah, the Torah is a huge soup pot. You know how many ladles it has? 613 ladles. And every mitzvah ladles out a little bit of that holiness into your bowl. So you're right. When we have, having a red heifer, it was one of the 613 ladles. And you perform the mitzvah, it ladles out. Perfection. We ain't got it. So what do? Every year we go right to the soup pot, but we don't have to worry about our manners. The soup pot means we go open up the chumash, that's the soup pot, and read the verses. To read the verses and take in the message, then you've accomplished everything that the paradum was meant to about. Now, of course, not on a halachic level. We can't confuse the halachic level. We still all remain tamei, because we've come in contact with the dead. We can't, but the existential tumah we've removed. The tumah that exists in your lifetime inside here, that's the tumah you want to remove. That's the most important tumah that you want to remove. And you want to live your life of tumah. So therefore, you're coming the holiday of Pesach. There's so much opportunity, Pesach. God will give you the greatest gifts of freedom. Unbelievable, what freedom that no one's going to hold you back from being able to do anything you want to do. But the problem is Hashem can give you freedom all day long. If you're still tamei, you're not going to access any of it. You got too many character flaws that are going to impede the ability for you to get that freedom. So we've read Shkolim, let's forget about the jealousy. We've read Zachar, let's forget about the lust. And now we're the Paraduma. Imagine being sprinkled with the water of a Paraduma to deal with our honor. That we're not such important people. And the biggest way to realize that you're not such a big deal is the whole mitzvah is a chok. You can't even understand it anyway. What God understands, you don't even understand. So how can you even think you're anybody important? God wrote a Torah. He wrote a mitzvah. You don't really understand how it works. We're so low compared to God. Where's the place to be arrogant? You should walk out of a hearing of the reading of Parsha. No arrogance for me. No more arrogance for me. And I'm not. And I don't think I'm smarter than everybody now. If not so arrogant, then when the rabbi has something to teach you, you might even learn it. You need to learn from other people. That's a big step. Then we can start learning from other people. Then you can start ladling in more Kedusha. And then you can come to Pesach and enjoy everything that Pesach has to give you. Okay, questions, comments?
So isn't the 49 days of the Omer really the spiritual lift? Isn't that the real
49 days of the Omer, which is another class for another time, is on Pesach, Hashem gives you a vision of the potential that you got. On Pesach, if you've done everything right till now, so on Pesach, Hashem will give you a perfect vision of what your full potential is now that you are getting rid of the three major character flaws. But now you've got to really work on that and make that vision become a reality. But you can't even, if you haven't taken care of this, if you're so arrogant and into lust and into honor, you're not even going to be able to believe the vision that you're seeing. So that's not for me. What are you talking about? I'm going to be religious. I'm going to forget it. You can't even begin to, you don't even get the vision. If you get the vision, you get a direction. Now I got to work hard. And now you have the ability to work hard. That becomes the details now.
Just one other question. Why wouldn't you do before Shabbos, for instance, instead of ducking the nickel, why not do sleepless? Why not do something that's really good?
You're supposed to. You're supposed to do it. If you look at all the customs of Shabbos, first of all, everyone's supposed to read Shir HaShirim. Song of Songs. Nobody does it because they're not leaving any time in Erev Shabbos. You need to leave yourself a good 20 minutes to say it. I know. Song of Songs is discussing the love relationship between us and God. That's tshuva. Tshuva from love. And you're supposed to, the rabbis say, you're supposed to do tshuva on Erev Shabbos. We know how to do tshuva. You know, you go through the 20 steps of tshuva. You know, regret, you know, acknowledging the sin, regret, and promising never to do it again. That's tshuva. They said, I've forgotten which city in Europe. I forgot. I just can't remember the city. There's a small city in Europe that the whole, and there was a lady who lived long enough to tell people about this. I just can't remember the city. That Erev Shabbos, the entire city, men and women, they came to the shul an hour before Shabbos, and the rabbi, this old-time religion, the rabbi would give them the strongest mussar, and they were crying and crying and crying every Erev Shabbos. And then he sent them home. And then they came back to shul afterwards. That's really what's supposed to happen. It's supposed to happen. That's all. It's all there. All the steps. Taking a nap on Erev Shabbos. All the things. It's all there to do tshuva. That's what Erev Shabbos is all about. You're right. Without that, and going to the mikvah is part of it. Going to the mikvah is part of it. And that's what, it's a tremendous opportunity to do tshuva. Unfortunately, as the great rabbis have said, that we were able to win the battle of Shabbos in North America, but we lost the battle of Erev Shabbos. In Europe, Rav Soloveitchik of blessed memory, he writes that in Europe, so I guess when him, it must have been, I don't know, the early 1900s, 1910, 1920s in Europe, he said you could feel Erev Shabbos. You knew it was Erev Shabbos, just in the air. It was a different Erev Shabbos. In North America, you don't see it. Maybe in little pockets, maybe in Borough Park. Maybe. But you don't feel it's Erev Shabbos. It's everybody's working until the last minute. You go from Friday to Shabbos. Doesn't go. And therefore the Shabbos isn't a Shabbos. So that's all part of it. That's why we read this on Shabbos. To be able, at least you have the presence of mind to hear the message, hopefully. Okay, thank you for listening. Next week there is no class. I'm still engaged with my son's wedding celebrations. And stay tuned to how many classes we'll have until Pesach. Usually what happens in the next couple of weeks is a big drop in attendance. So I don't mind to give the class, but it has to be a certain amount of people to warrant the energy I put into this. So we will see. Maybe we'll give Shireen the mitzvah to scout out the crowd and see who's prepared to come in 2 weeks. That's already getting dangerously close to Pesach. That's right. I don't blame anybody. That's fine.